When I was in the fifth grade, I transferred from a private Christian school to a public elementary school in town. If you don't know me, I'm an extrovert. And so I was like, oh, I'm so excited for a new setting and new friends. So that day I walked into Mr. McCarthy's room, I had a new perm and a big smile on my face. I was certain that my fifth grade year was going to be the best year yet. What I was met with instead was mockery and ridicule and words said to me and about me that still bring tears to my eyes today. They made fun of my Christian faith, my personality, my weight, even the fact that the jean jacket that I got for Christmas had a zipper, not snaps like the other girls. It was relentless. And I remember being stuck in the middle of it all and being so confused because I knew who I was. I knew what I had to offer as a friend. And the fact that the other kids couldn't see that was so confusing. And if I'm honest, it was also confusing that the God that I loved and had committed my life to was allowing this to happen day after day after day. Last week, Kyle kicked off our new series entitled Unwavering, which is looking at the ministry of the minor prophet Habakkuk. And even though we know just a little bit about Habakkuk compared to guys like Ezekiel and Jeremiah and Daniel, his interactions with God and his attitude toward God definitely make up for his brief bio. He models for us what to do when life is confusing, when people are confused around us, and when it feels like the walls are just caving in. So let's turn now there in the Bible. If you're using the Bible in the pew rack in front of you, you'll find it on 1427. If you're using your own Bible, good for you and good luck. Those minor prophets are sneaky in the way that they hide. But we're going to look at Habakkuk chapter 1. If you weren't here last week or you just need a little refresher, Habakkuk lived in a time of turmoil and tension. There was an international crisis brewing between the Assyrians and the Babylonians, and it was coming to a head, and it was terrifying for the people of God. The Assyrians had been a superpower for a long time, and they were threatening and domineering and seemingly undefeatable. But then come the Babylonians, and they defeat the Assyrians that were so strong and confident. And the Babylonians were ruthless, godless, violent, abusive, and arrogant, and they were moving closer and closer. But the home of Habakkuk that they were moving closer to wasn't doing well either. Life seemed like a modern-day roller coaster ride for Habakkuk as power was passed from king to king. So it started out strong with Hezekiah, who we studied in our last series. He brought the people back to serving the Lord, but then that power faltered big time when his son took over, and he actually brought everybody back to idol worship and child sacrifice and other detestable acts. Then young Josiah, was made king, and I don't say young as a euphemism to make him feel better. The boy was 8 years old when he took the throne. And he is one who brought people to the worship of the Lord again. And in Scripture, 2 Chronicles 34:2, it says of Josiah, he did what was right in the eyes of the Lord and followed the ways of his father David, not turning aside to the right or to the left. And that seems promising, right? But then 31 years later, Josiah was killed in battle and his son took over. And the Bible simply says of him, he did evil in the eyes of the Lord. So it's up and down and left and right and being jerked around with violence in the streets and corrupt priests in the temple and political chaos. And it's in the midst of this roller coaster ride, sick to his stomach, that Habakkuk cries out to the Lord. In verses 2-4, here's what he said. How long, Lord, must I call for help, but you do not listen? Or cry out to you, violence, but you do not save? Why do you make me look at injustice? Why do you tolerate wrongdoing? Destruction and violence are before me. There is strife and conflict abounds. Therefore, the law is paralyzed and justice never prevails. At first glance, it can seem that Habakkuk's words here are just an angry rant. But they're actually an introduction to what the people of God called a lament. A lament is a God-given way for us to express our sorrow, grief, despair, and confusion to God while still seeking Him and His promises. The lament is a cry of God's people when they're stuck in the middle of circumstances or surrounded by circumstances that just don't make sense. And the practice of lament is actually seen all throughout Scripture, but we just often don't recognize it. Job, the man that God described as unlike anyone else on earth, blameless and upright, a man who fears God and shuns evil, he laments all throughout the book dedicated to his name. In Job 7:20, Job cries out in lament, "If I have sinned, what have I done to you, you who see everything we do? Why have you made me your target? Have I become a burden to you?" David, who we know is a man after God's own heart, and he was God's chosen king for God's chosen people, he laments all the way through the Psalms. Listen to his despair in Psalm 69. "Save me, O God, for the waters have come up to my neck. I sink in the miry depths where there is no foothold. I've come into the deep waters, the floods engulf me. I am worn out calling for help. My throat is parched. My eyes fail looking for my God." Lament is the raw and real language of faith. It's what we do when we don't know what else to do. And it's what we do not because of a lack of belief in God, but because we know that we love and serve a God who keeps his promises. And it's what Habakkuk did, and he did it well. Last week, we dug into Habakkuk's lament, seeing that his questions were good and that they were based on his confidence in God. And then Kyle basically said, "to be continued," which, by the way, as a girl growing up in the 80s, I did not like to see those words come across the screen at the end of my show. Because I wanted to know, did Wonder Woman get the truth out of the guy that she had in her truth lasso? Did Laura Ingalls get in trouble for putting the extra pepper in Nellie's dessert and meal that she was going to give to Almanzo? I wanted to know that now. And you guys have been sitting in that tension all week. Good for you. So let's get into it. Habakkuk chapter 1, verse 5. This is God's response to Habakkuk's lament. "Look at the nations and watch and be utterly amazed, for I am going to do something in your days that you would not believe even if you were told." Look at that. It's like God has Habakkuk on the edge of his seat. If we were people who like to take verses out of context, meaning we take away their meaning and their depth, this would be an awesome verse to like stitch on a pillow, throw on a bumper sticker, put on a t-shirt. But this isn't the end of the message. And it certainly wasn't the message that Habakkuk was expecting. And the message changes verse 5. Let's continue on with verse 6. God said, I am raising up the Babylonians, that ruthless and impetuous people who sweep across the whole earth to seize dwellings not their own. They are a feared and dreaded people. They are a law to themselves and promote their own honor. Their horses are swifter than leopards, fiercer than wolves at dusk. Their cavalry gallops headlong. Their horsemen come from afar. They fly like an eagle swooping to devour. They all come intent on violence. Their hordes advance like a desert wind and gather prisoners like sand. They mock kings and scoff at rulers. They laugh at all the fortified cities. By building earthen ramps, they capture them. Then they sweep past like the wind and go on, guilty people whose own strength is their God. I know I can't know Habakkuk's mind, but I've got to believe that this is not the response he was expecting from God to his lament. I mean, the wrongdoings and the destruction that Habakkuk was referring to in his lament, where he said, destruction and violence are before me. There is strife and conflict abounds. All of that was inflicted by the very same group that God is now saying, I am going to raise up. What, God? I can't even imagine his confusion. Habakkuk was in the middle of God's story, and that can be a very difficult place to be. I'm convinced that none of us like to be in the middle of a story. In the midst of the pain and uncertain of how the end of the story will be, we don't like to sit in the hard. And actually, we do everything that we can to avoid it and to get through it as quickly as we can. Like when you're stuck in the middle of rehab for an injury or surgery. The pain is so severe and the physical therapy exercises are so overwhelming, and you wonder, will there be healing on the other side? Or like when you're stuck in the middle of what seems like a failing marriage. You want so much to make it work. But every day, every conversation, every interaction is just a grind. Or when you're stuck with a diagnosis of aggressive cancer and you have taken the opportunity to fight it with every opportunity they've given you, but the doctors have told you there's nothing more that they can do. In those heavy moments, we have a choice in our posture of belief toward our painful reality. Either God is in control or nothing is, and we have no hope. Even though God's response to Habakkuk was the opposite of what he hoped for, Habakkuk knew that God was in control. The Babylonians were not in control. God was in control. And that truth had to break through the fear and despair that Habakkuk felt so that he could move forward. Dallas Willard, in his book, Renovation of the Heart, writes something profound about this choice that we have. He says, this has special importance when I am faced with the presence of evil and suffering in human life, my own or at large. I realize that I will allow my view of evil to determine my view of God and will cut him down accordingly, or I will allow my view of God to determine my view of evil and will elevate him accordingly, accepting that nothing is beyond his power for good. So the question is, can Habakkuk, in the middle of this story, trust that God is in control and has a bigger view of reality? That God would take what was intended for harm and destruction and he would redeem it. Our advantage is that we know the end of Habakkuk's story, the one that he was in the middle of. We know that God's plan was advancing and that one day there would be a Redeemer that came to make everything right. We know that God the Father would send his one and only Son into the world to save us from an even greater threat than the Babylonians, our sin. And Jesus would live, die on the cross, and rise again so that we could have eternal life and a full life now. So fast forward to the New Testament. Jesus is with his disciples, and he knows what's coming. He knows that he's going to the cross. He knows that Jerusalem will be destroyed. And he knows that his followers are going to experience persecution and suffering. And he shares a message with them very similar to the one that Habakkuk received from God. In Matthew 24, 4 through 6, Jesus said, "Watch out that no one deceives you, for many will come in my name, claiming I am the Messiah, and will deceive many. You will hear of wars and rumors of wars, but see to it that you are not alarmed. Such things must happen, but the end is still to come." See to it that you are not alarmed. Don't be troubled. You'll hear of wars and rumors of wars. Nations will rise up against nations, but don't be alarmed. Why? Because these things must happen, but they are not the end of the story. Jesus also said in John 16:33 to his disciples, "I have told you these things so that in me you may have peace. In this world you will have trouble, but take heart, I have overcome the world." Jesus does not promise us a life without trouble. Just like the opposite message Habakkuk received, Jesus told the disciples and tells us now, "You will have trouble. But I'm still in control. Stay with me and I will give you peace. Stay with me and we will celebrate at the end of the story." There's a powerful account about a preacher named Donald Gray Barnhouse that illustrates this truth. In September of 1939, Barnhouse was invited to preach at a church in Belfast, Ireland. Earlier that week, Hitler had invaded Poland, and the British Prime Minister had given Hitler an ultimatum: withdraw by Sunday morning at 11 a.m., or England would declare war on Germany. Just as Barnhouse stood up to preach, he was handed a note by the pastor that read, "No reply from Hitler. The Prime Minister has declared war." And the pastor, clearly an encourager, said, "I hope you have a good sermon today. It may be the last sermon these men ever hear." I mean, talk about pressure. So Barnhouse opened his Bible to Matthew 24, 6, and he read Jesus' words, "You will hear of wars and rumors of wars, but see that you not be troubled." And then he began to paint a picture of the horrors of war. Millions of homes will be broken up. See that you be not troubled. Children will be torn from their mothers. See that you be not troubled. Husbands and brothers will perish in battle. See that you be not troubled. Innocent blood will flow like a river. See that you be not troubled. Children will be left orphans. See that you be not troubled. The tension was rising in the room. People were weeping. And then Barnhouse looked up to the heaven and he cried out, "Don't be troubled. These words are either the words of a madman or the words of God himself. How can these words be spoken to men and women who have hearts that can weep and feel compassion? Unless Jesus is God, he has no right to tell us, don't be troubled. But if Jesus is God, if he is the God of history, if he is in control of every circumstance, then we can trust him. Either God is in control or nothing is, and we have no hope. Barnhouse went on to explain that Jesus is God. He is sovereign over history. And even in the darkest moments, even when war breaks out, even when evil seems to be winning, God is working his plan and his purpose. Just think of how depressing and dark the morning after the burial of Jesus seemed. But they knew, we know, that Easter was coming. Are you stuck today in the middle of a story? Are you desperate? Are you confused? What do we do? What do we do in the middle of a story? I believe that we lament, like the Bible instructs us to do. Remember, the definition is that a lament is a God-given way for us to express our sorrow, grief, despair, and confusion to God. But the last part is so important, while still seeking him and his promises. So the way I look at it, here's what we need to do. We lament faithfully. One scholar said that there is an unfaithful lament and there is a faithful lament. An unfaithful lament is when we practice self-destruction or abusive behavior toward other people, toward ourselves, or toward God. It's when we say, how could God allow, and fill in the blank. A faithful lament is one brought right to God himself, where you say, God, how could you allow? And I know that it seems to be a subtle difference, but it's a really important one. Habakkuk was faithful in his lament. He took them directly to God, and then he waited for an answer. We lament intention. In the last few months, I have sat with way too many individuals and families who are in really hard realities. Stories that have ended in death of a loved one or will end in death with people so, so young. And as we brought our laments to the Lord in those spaces, I shared about the tension of lament. We need to hold in tension two truths: our honest reality and God's ability to change that reality. This revelation of lament came to me when our family was walking alongside of my dad when he was diagnosed with lung cancer. Never smoked a day in his life, but he had an inoperable tumor that was wrapped around the stem of his lung, and the cancerous fluid had escaped from the tumor into the chest cavity. As a faith-filled family who believes in an all-powerful God, we prayed fervently that the Lord would heal our dad. We were convinced that God could do it, and we prayed that he would. And as we heard the statistics that 80% of people with this kind of cancer only live 1 year, and that 20% make it 2 years, but nobody beyond that, we had to be honest about our reality, that Marty Heinch could take his last breath on this side of heaven on that same day. And friends, I will tell you, it is so incredibly difficult to live each day holding those two truths in tension. But I'm convinced that that is the spirit of lament. We believe he can, and we commit to trust him, even if he doesn't answer in the way that we want him to. But finally, we lament with hope. The Old Testament book of Lamentations, written after Jerusalem was destroyed by the Babylonians in 586 BC, is so full of laments that the book is literally called Lamentations. And it's true that the first two chapters are filled with statements like, "The Lord is like an enemy," and "The visions of your prophets were false and worthless." But chapter 3 brings light to the heart of lament. Watch this in Lamentations 3, 19 through 24. "I remember my affliction and my wandering, the bitterness and the gall. I well remember them, and my soul is downcast within me. Yet this I call to mind, and therefore I have hope. Because of the Lord's great love, we are not consumed, for his compassions never fail. They are new every morning. Great is your faithfulness. I say to myself, the Lord is my portion, therefore I will wait for him." Did you see what happened? In the middle of the anguish and the grief, the lamenter says, "Yet this I call to mind, and therefore I have hope." And then he continues to call out the truth of God that he knows, the truth of God that he has seen in his life. And it gives him hope, because hope is a key element in a faithful lament. Mark Vrogup wrote a book on lament called Dark Clouds, Deep Mercy. And in it, he writes this: "You might think lament is the opposite of praise. It isn't. Instead, lament is a path to praise as we are led through our brokenness and disappointment. The space between brokenness and God's mercy is where the song is sung. Think of lament as the transition between pain and promise. It is the path from heartbreak to hope." I wish I could go back in time and encourage fifth grade Heather Heinch. I would validate to her that being in the middle of a story stinks. I would validate that the words that were said to her and of her were not right. But I would assure her that God was at work, and that he was going to redeem those times and that story for her good and for his glory. And I would give her permission to lament to the God who sees her and loves her. And that's what I want to do for all of us today. I want to not only give us the permission, but give us the space to lament to the God who sees us and loves us. I'm going to ask the worship team to come, and I'm going to first lead us through some prompts of prayer lament in the quiet of your space and in the quiet of your heart. And then together we are going to sing a song of lament. So if you trust me, would you shut your eyes? And would you block out all the distractions around you? And in the quiet of your heart, just tell God What situation, hurt, or relationship has been coming to your mind while I've been sharing about the hard in life? Tell him how that situation makes you feel. I give you permission to ask him the questions that are tripping you up. Tell him what is confusing to you. Now, ask for what you hope for. Then, in faith, tell him that you choose to trust him for the outcome. And now, I want you to call out all the truth of you know that you know of God, the promises that he's given, and the way that he's shown himself faithful in your life so far.